This cassette is prepared and presented by the Church of God International, sponsor of the Armor of God radio broadcast and telecast.
Hello, everyone. And Bronson, how are you today?
Just fine. Ready to go with our special presentation of this offer for our listeners and viewers alike.
We want to deal with the subject of spiritual nullification today, Vance. You doing all right today?
Doing great.
Well, this is something that all three of us know a lot about, because working in the field of religion and being ministers, what we're talking about today applies not only to our listeners, but applies to all of us, because much of the material we'll be covering today deals with spiritual leaders. And I think it is appropriate in the climate that we have in our country today to talk about it from the viewpoint of not only those who are not necessarily elders in churches, but to our people, but also not to neglect what the Bible would call the Pharisees and or it applies to us today. We hope we're not Pharisees, but the spiritual leaders. And this is, let me tell you why this came up. I was reading an article about speaking, and it talked in there how there is what the speaker's nullification. What that meant was is that a speaker can get up and give a message, but while he's speaking, or because the way in which he speaks, his message does not get across. And it referred to something which I've never really studied, but I assume it's true, and that's called jury nullification. And what this meant is that in a court case, a prosecutor, for example, could absolutely have the truth. In other words, he would know, he would be presenting the evidence, which was undeniable, that the person that they were trying was guilty. And the person they're trying is guilty. But the jury is an audience of, how many people, Bronson? 10, 12
Well, it
people?
Varies for a criminal situation is 12.
12 people. Let's assume,
of course,
12.
Of course, before that time, you have a grand jury, which can be any number, or a higher number than 12. But generally, in an average trial of a criminal nature, you're talking 12.
Well, what I found interesting here is that the jury could be presented with the evidence, with the undeniable truth, but because of the way in which it was presented, a phenomenon called jury nullification occurs, meaning that the individual who is guilty is let go because the way in which it is presented, I'll put it in modern lingo, is
turns the jury off.
And sometimes jury nullification, which is a rather new term, though historically, in the United States, for instance, juries have been nullified on the basis. Go back to the pre-civil rights movement, when juries would traditionally bring in not guilty verdicts for an individual accused of a crime against another person on the basis of race or something like that. Jury just on the basis of, well, you know, he's one of the good old boys, we're not going to find him guilty, may be a significant person in the community and or son of a significant person. And so the jury nullified a right judgment in that situation.
Well, the reason why this is important is the same thing occurs scripturally and spiritually speaking. And that is basically any one of us can be unknowingly or even knowingly guilty of turning people away from the truth because of the way in which we witness and or our personal failures or the way we act or present the truth, etc. So I wanted to talk about that today, and here was a little newspaper clipping which I thought illustrated this to some degree. And this appeared in the Dallas Morning News. I cut it out a couple of days ago. But it involves a letter that a woman in her 30s sent in. And let me just read a quote from it. She says, "My father recently died, and as I began to clean his house, I came across some very upsetting things." And what this deals with is that appearances can be very deceiving. I think all three of us know that. You know, a person, even a person who is a religious leader, can give a certain air and or appearance and or opinions, and yet what you see is not what you get. This article deals with this to some degree. She says, "I came upon a medium-sized collection of child pornography. It upsets me to even write out these words. I previously thought my dad was a decent, though not perfect, person." Of course, all of us know none of us are perfect. All of us have our faults and our sins. But she says, "But now I'm not sure. The pictures were unbelievably shocking and apparently were purchased on the Internet. The girls involved were definitely prepubescent and were pictured with adult men. I had thought my dad, as she says, went to heaven. She says, but now I don't think he did. I couldn't decide what to do with the pictures, but I knew that even the possession of such pictures was illegal. I decided to burn them in the fireplace. I have such sympathy for the girls, now probably women, pictured. And the reason why that caught my attention is here's a woman who's now grown up, a girl, a daughter, who was totally shocked and surprised to find out that a man that she thought was perfect was in fact very much human. And that is as it should be, I guess, or is with all of us, but what's tragic is sometimes as it gets into spiritual leadership, there's a particular tragedy or travesty that occurs. And that's what I think Jesus is referring to as we turn along here to Matthew chapter 23. Now, appearances of Vance, Bronson, I think we all agree, appearances are very, very deceiving.
Oh, yeah. I can never forget the adage, you can't judge a book by its cover.
Yeah, exactly.
Or beauty's only skin deep. You know, those aphorisms, because they indicate that what you see is not always what you get.
And with Christianity, though, we should certainly be representatives of Jesus Christ. And there shouldn't be any fakery or misdirection in that. You know, I see people come to church, Bronson, in advance, and they really can put on their Sabbath best. They can put on the smile. And, for example, in marriage, I see people come to church, and they can smile, they can shake hands, they can give the appearance of being happy, smiling and holding hands, and yet when they leave church, they go home, and they hold grudges, and they fight. It appears to be one way, in reality, it's another.
Sometimes it really spills over into the church. They try to keep that good front going, but they're always posturing, they're always trying to get an alliance together with their point of view about an issue that may be trivial when you get down to it. And that's unfortunate, because we ought to be people, what people see of us is ought to be what we are.
To be genuine. We all know, because of past histories in religious organizations, that congregations and churches are truly stunned when someone who is perceived to be spiritually well or healthy is suddenly exposed to spiritually diseased. And we want to talk about that today, because we don't want any of our people, nor do we want ourselves falling into that trap. Probably the best place to go to look at this, to begin, is over Matthew chapter 23. And this breaks into a series of what are called the woes directed to the religious leaders of that day, and that's the Pharisees. I wanted to notice, though, in verse 13, something that caught my attention. I've read these verses many, many times, but never really noticed this one little expression. Jesus says here to the Pharisees, "Woe unto you, scribes and you Pharisees, hypocrites," big exclamation point after that, "for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men." In other words, they close the doors. They make it impossible for men or women to enter into the kingdom. He says, "For you neither go in yourselves, neither suffer you them that are entering to go in." That is a pretty serious indictment.
I believe it is, and I've thought about how that applies in our modern times for religious leaders, and not so much just religious leaders, but those who proclaim themselves to be religious. It happens in politics, where you have a politician who proclaims themselves to be spiritual minded, and you find out later on that there are these skeletons clanging around in the closet. But generally, we like to apply this to religious leaders, but for all of us, when we think about shutting up the kingdom of heaven, how we block the kingdom off from other people is that they come to find out what we really like, and they're no longer interested based on how we have conducted ourselves. They find us to be hypocritical, they find us to be judgmental and condemnatory and all those kinds of things, and they figure if this is what the kingdom is like, I don't want any part of it.
Right.
I think it's interesting that the word hypocrites is used repeatedly here. In verse 13 he says, "But woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." Again in verse 14, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." And then down in verse 23, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." Again in verse 25, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." And then it's in verse 27, and repeatedly he calls them hypocrites, meaning they appear to be one thing when in fact they are something else. And this has, in some way, has an effect upon people's lives. The people that they're attempting to influence, they shut up the kingdom of heaven to those people. And this can happen in a number of ways. One of the ways, of course, is when those people see them for what they are, and it then destroys any spirituality, any concept of spirituality, or they just lose their faith, they lose their trust in religious leaders in general, and sometimes they tend to throw everything out.
Well, you know, the question I'd like to ask the two of you, and I'll chime in on it as well, is several years ago I heard this expression, don't judge the message by the messenger. And that's true. I mean, I understand how that is meant, but I'll tell you what, it's a little bit fraught because it's almost impossible to not do that. In other words, we do judge the message by the messenger. And the thing that I thought of when I heard that expression is, okay, a person who is a sinner, we're all sinners, by the way, can't present the truth. I grant you that. There's no question about it. But on the other hand, if the messenger who presents the truth is doing something that's contrary to what Jesus Christ would want him to do, wouldn't it be more sensible and logical for the spiritual leaders to be abiding by the message that they preach rather than being the opposite of the message that they're preaching?
Well, it makes it very difficult to believe the message when you hear the messenger saying one thing and then doing just the opposite. And in reality, there's a certain principle there that people ought to pay attention to. And that principle, I believe Jesus himself brought it out, is does an evil tree bring forth good fruits? And naturally, you know, that's a universal principle. Normally, evil or bad trees don't produce good fruit. Now, the problem is when you hear on the occasion someone producing something that is true, expounding certain scriptural truths, and then you find his lifestyle is just the opposite, then what happens? That universal principle kicks in. You think, well, this is an evil tree. He can't be producing good fruit, so therefore the fruit must be bad too.
It nullifies the
quality. It nullifies. That's right. Exactly.
Well, what I see here is that Jesus, in this one chapter and other places as well, is he helps us sort through spiritual sickness, which is often masked by commendable religious behavior. And, you know, commendable religious behavior is so hard to get beneath that, but yet Jesus does here, and he probes through that spiritual skin of devoted religious leaders, and he helps us see, or he diagnoses, these hidden problems. And we're going to take a look at just a couple of them. But one of the things that is interesting to me is I sort of see the religious leaders here poised as guardians of the kingdom. And there's no reason for me to suspect otherwise. It looks to me like that they're self-appointed. They're there voluntarily. It's their position to go and stand at the door and sort of monitor who comes in and who doesn't get in. And yet Jesus didn't appoint them. You can't find there that they were appointed to do that. They sort of took it upon themselves. And the language that Jesus uses here is so direct and so blunt that it would be foolish of us today in the modern church to ignore the warnings as we ourselves consider the likelihood of this happening to us.
You know, watching Jesus navigate through the 3.5 years of that ministry that certainly turned the world upside down, he was confronted continually by those who were posturers. These were religious individuals. Occasionally, the case of the Nicodemus who came honestly to him, though by night, to ask some serious questions. By and large, the people he came in contact with on a regular basis were individuals trying to maintain their religious posture in the community, their acceptability. And when he confronted them on issues that they thought they knew, that they had gone to seminary, if I may use that term, and studied with various religious leaders and had their degrees and all that kind of thing, their view of what God wanted for humankind was in contrast to what Jesus said was necessary. Now, I think he was penetrating their veneer, their cloak of righteousness, and proclaiming to them that you don't have it right. But it was later for the Apostle Paul to, I think, make a dramatic presentation in his great work in the book of Romans, where he takes on both the Gentile and Jewish communities who both thought of themselves as significant. The Jews for one reason, or several reasons I should say, the Gentiles for other sets of reasons, and he takes them both on in a very dramatic way, in fact, leaves no stone unturned on what is truly required and how we're supposed to conduct our lives. So I think if we maybe took a look at what Paul had to deal with in a definite religious community that was populated by both Jews and Gentiles, and I think we find a lesson there by which we can make some changes in our own lives, because I think that's ultimately what we're talking about.
That's right.
To those who are listening to us today.
When I look at Matthew chapter 23, I see an expression used by the Apostle Paul that was also used by Jesus. And you might notice, for example, Vance was touching on this a while ago, but in verse 16 it says, "You blind guys." And leaping ahead of where we're going to go just a little bit, over here in Romans chapter 2, he also talked to them about being guides. In verse 19, he says, "And are confident that you yourself are the guide of the blind." So this word guide, it becomes of interest to us. And that's what spiritual leaders are supposed to be. Now, let me make my point, though. It doesn't just apply to elders and teachers. It applies to anyone and everyone. You know, I was once asked the question, Bronson, in advance, do you think that ministers are held to a higher standard? And my answer to that was, yes, I believe that ministers are held to a higher standard, but all people are held to the same standard. It's just that ministers are expected not to do certain things and to do certain things that may not be required of lay members, because lay members aren't up speaking before the audience. So today I want to talk about it from the viewpoint of those who are confident that we are guides of those who are blind. And a good place to start is in Romans chapter 2, to follow up what Jesus instructed or gave us instruction to the religious leaders over in Matthew 23. I'll read the first three verses, and then Bronson, maybe you can follow up, and we'll work our way through this chapter and see if there are not some insightful lessons here for us to learn. Romans chapter 2, verse 1 says, "Wherefore you are inexcusable." In other words, you're without excuse, O man, whosoever you are that judges. And it's a proclivity, and if we do a little research on this, we'll find here that in Romans chapter 2, the Apostle Paul shifts his instruction away from the Gentiles in Romans chapter 1 to now a conversation most likely with a Jewish convert. Now, like the religious leaders in Jesus' day, I don't question that this man had his theology right. I doubt that he had any qualms about keeping the Ten Commandments. I consider that he probably felt he had a pretty good relationship as a Jew, one of the seed of Abraham, with God the Father. So the theology, that package was all there, and yet there was something beneath it all, some disease, if you will, something that was not as it should be.
And I would say, Charles, that this is probably a hypothetical man.
Hypothetical,
that whoever
yeah.
you are,
right.
If you read the context, as you have pointed out, he's obviously referring to the Jew-Gentile relationships within the church. He's just dealt with the Gentiles, talked about iniquity, wickedness in the earth, and now then he's going to turn his attention to the other party, as it were,
the other group.
To deal with that.
So. That's right. So he's talking to a group of people, and really could be talking to us today. He says, "O man, whosoever you are that judges, for wherein you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you that judge doeth the same things." And that's what we want to talk about. What arrogance for individuals to judge people when they themselves are doing the same things. You know, we ought to get out of the judging business in terms of condemning, not evaluating sin. I think
right.
that we have the right to evaluate and or make judgments on right or wrong as it applies to my life. I'll tell you something, the longer I spend in the ministry, I'll tell you, it's unwise to be in the judging business, you know. I don't want people drawn to my opinions, because my opinions can be wrong. I do want them to be drawn to the testimony of Jesus Christ, because I know then they're right.
And you notice, especially here, he's talking about hypocritical judging, or you who judge practice the same things. He outlines those things in chapter 1. You know, you Jewish convert, you're judging the Gentile because, well, you know, look at his idolatrous family, look at the sins of the Gentiles through the ages. And he says, you hypocrite, you do the same thing.
There's quite a list of them there in that first chapter, and that's where the second chapter is actually, when you see the words therefore or wherefore, it refers back to something he's already said. In those last verses of chapter 1, it talks about being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, verse 29, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit. I mean, all of that was something present in the Gentile world, and then he turns his attention to the Jews and says, you're like this too.
That's right. And I can sort of see the scenario. This group of people are saying, all right, after chapter 1, boy, give it to him. That's exactly right. You're right on. And then all of a sudden, Paul turns it toward that group of people.
If I could make one other point in relation to the overall topic here, and that is that what a marvelous witness each side, if you want to call them sides, could be to the other. Mm-hmm. Here you have the Jewish community seeing Gentiles embrace their Messiah, right, the Jewish Messiah, and on the other hand, you see the Gentiles seeing the Jews live out this fulfillment, you know, the whole thing, what the law was all about and the prophets and pointing toward the Messiah.
Right.
What a marvelous witness they could have been to each other and should have been, and yet here they are judging each other in a hypocritical fashion.
That's right.
And nullifying.
And that nullified what could have been.
That's right.
Exactly. Well, now verse 2, he says, for we are sure that the judgment of God is according to truth. And what that means is truth in contrast to appearances. That God judges not by the appearance, but by what in fact is real and true. He says, but we are sure that the judgment of God is according to truth against them which commit such things. So there were things going on that ought not to have been. If you will, we probe beneath that veneer, that appearance and that surface, and we find out that there is in fact, even where there is the appearance of righteousness, there is spiritual sickness. Verse 3, and think you this, O man, that judges them which do such things, and do the same. Again, there's that expression. You judge people for doing something, and yet you yourself are doing the very same thing. Do you think that you shall escape the judgment of God? And I think it's obvious they will not.
This point is driven home from Genesis to Revelation about how it is that an individual can look askance at someone else. I think Jesus put it this way. You have there's a brother who has a little speck in their eye, and yet you've got this huge beam, this 4x4 sticking out, this plank sticking out of your eye. And he said that in the Matthew 7 chapter dealing with judging. You know, judge not that you be not judged or condemned. And this is not at all referring to righteous judgment in the sense of making evaluations based on the Word of God. That's not what he's talking about. But the notion that you are not right, but you're making a condemnation of someone else, and you have not rectified your own situation. And he goes on here, I guess, want me to pick up from this point, to show the patience that God has, and he expresses it in a very interesting way when he gets down to a point that God doesn't have a respect of persons on the basis of the things that we think is significant. I mean, in our country today, in the United States, there's this great wave of religious debate back and forth. We have what we call the religious right, and I guess that means there's an irreligious left in logic, but there's this battle for moral high ground. It says, or the deepest, this was verse 4, or despises you the riches of his goodness and forbearance and long-suffering, not knowing that the goodness of God leads you to repentance. In other words, God is patient towards his people, be they the Jews anciently and historically, even up to that present time, or with the Gentiles. He exhibits patience in order that his repentance, that he can lead people to that place of repentance. Instead of exalting in that and luxuriating in that, we take it for granted, and that's what he's getting to them about right now. But after your hardness and impenitent heart treasures up unto yourself wrath against the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God, there's these phrases that show up here, the goodness of God in verse 4 and then the wrath of God in verse 5. God will be good, he will be patient, but his patience runs out. That's what is being said here. And so in verse 5, it's being stored up. If you don't take advantage of his patience and his goodness towards you, then you're going to have to deal with the wrath that comes. Verse 6, who will render to every man according to his deeds. Now, that is problematical. If God is going to render to every one of us according to our deeds, I guess we ought to be a little bit more careful about what deeds we stockpile, what deeds we show, and how we live our lives. And that's essentially what he's saying to the audience here. To them who by patient continuance in well-doing seek for glory and honor and immortality, eternal life. That's going to be the end result if you do certain things. Verse 8. But unto them that are contentious, I don't recall such a contentious time as this that we are presently in when it comes to religion. You know, it's been in the news quite a bit lately, in the political spectrum of things, people writing letters and apologizing for this, and religious activity, and people feeling somehow justified or unjustified or put upon or denigrated or all that kind of stuff. But this verse says, those who continue, who are continuous in their deportment, and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation and wrath is going to be the result in verse 8. Tribulation and anguish upon every soul of man that does evil, of the Jew first and also the Gentile. Now, historically, he is saying that the Jews, going all the way back to the time that they went into their first captivity, or the Babylonian captivity in particular, but there were other times they were beat up on historically because God was dealing with them specifically. All right? To them first, they got the first retribution, and then also the Gentile. Now, that wrath, the result of unrighteousness and all of the hypocrisy that goes, will result in some chaos. But verse 10 says, but glory, honor, and peace to every man that works good, to the Jew first, and to the Gentile. In other words, God had an order of how he was doing things. It didn't mean that the Jews were better than the Gentiles, and that was the big argument in this church. The situation in the church was that originally it was a Jewish congregation. When Claudius, I think it was, the emperor of Rome, banned all the Jews from Rome and kicked them out, the church took on a Gentile flavor until Nero came to power, the emperor Nero, and invited the Jews back. And so they were a lesser population now in the congregation here in Rome that Paul is writing to. But be that as it may, Paul is taking both sides on to deal with them and to illustrate the central point of verse 11. For there is no respect of persons with God. I wish we would believe that today.
I like the way this translation, this is the New King James Version, says, for there is no partiality with God.
I like that
wording.
Yeah.
You know, Bronson, the key here is in verse 9 says, every soul who does evil.
Mm-hmm.
That means regardless who you are. And also those who do good. It says everyone in verse 10 who does good. Jew or Gentile.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't make any difference.
It's the same standard.
The same standard. And that's the theme here as we continue on in verse 12. Then he introduces the subject of the law. And some would think naturally that since the Jews have the law, their ancestors received the law. And perhaps it could be said they have something to be proud about there. But Paul makes his argument here, it doesn't matter, whoever you are still guilty, Jew or Gentile. And he explains why that can be, or how that can be so. Verse 12, he says, for as many as have sinned without law also will also perish without law. What does he mean, without law? Now, there's nobody really that's truly without law in the ultimate sense, but what he's talking about here, he's talking about the Gentiles, whose ancestors did not receive the law at Mount Sinai, those who did not receive the covenant. They were not participants in that covenant.
Right.
But those who were without, if you sin, in other words, it's telling us that sin is still, it still applies. A person can sin even though he's not among those people who received the law. And we know, of course, the law does define sin. It tells us what sin is. Nevertheless, Paul is pointing out here that it's not restricted just to those who received the law. It says that as many as have sinned in the law, that would be the Jews, will be judged by the law, because it's the law that's pointing the finger at them and condemning them. Then verse 13 he says, for not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. This is not a statement advocating or in any way suggesting that a person, his justification is earned through good works. He's simply stating that those people who have this obedient spirit, that's a part of faith. When Paul speaks of being justified by faith, that faith certainly includes obedience. And the person who is of an obedient mindset toward God, if he's obedient, then this is the person who is justified. Before I continue here, though, I'd like to go back for just a moment to chapter 1 and underscore some important things here. In chapter 1, he's talking about the legacy of mankind in general. He says in verse 24, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, that's God's invisible attributes, are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. So, in other words, these people who were practicing the things outlined in chapter 1, they didn't have the law, but they did have the witness of creation. And Paul here is saying the witness of creation exposes their sinfulness. And this is what he has in mind down in, as we're reading here in verse 13 and beginning now in verse 14. He says, for when Gentiles, this is back in chapter 2, for when Gentiles who do not have the law, by nature, do the things in the law. In other words, there is a universal conception of certain right and wrong principles. You can go to the primitive tribes of the world and you see among them morality, concepts of morality. Mm-hmm. There are laws, for example, against murder, against adultery in some cases, against theft and other things. So there's something in the nature of man, unless that nature has been corrupted, that allows him to see right and wrong. So for when Gentiles, again, verse 14 in chapter 2, who do not have the law by nature do things in the law, these, although not having the law, that's the Old Testament law that the Jews had, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, in other words, it's in the nature of things, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. So they had this concept of right and wrong. They understood morality, ethics, justice, and things of that nature. And when they went contrary to those things which they naturally understood, then they were condemned, just like the Jew would be condemned for doing things contrary to the law that he had received or his ancestors had received. And it goes on in verse 16, in the day when God will judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ, according to my gospel. So again, it doesn't matter who you are, Jew or Gentile. Mm-hmm. And in our situation today, it doesn't matter whether you're a descendant of Abraham or whether you are in your background you're of African descent or of European. It doesn't matter. Whoever you are, you have a certain light, and you are condemned when you break that law, which is universal.
Well, now we pick up in verse 17, Bronson advanced direction specifically now at this group, and it's addressed as if it were a single person, but he says, unto you, Jew, behold you that are called a Jew, and you make your rest in the law. And when I read those verses, these verses frighten me to some degree, because I realize that representing Christ and teaching his word, these verses, the next few verses here, fall heavily upon our shoulders, because we've got to be sure as best we can, although we know our human failings, that we do not give an appearance which is not supported from what's within. And he says here, you know, you make your rest in the law, and you make your boast of God, and you know his will, and you approve the things that are more excellent, being instructed out of the law, and art confident that you yourself are the guide of the blind, those who do not have the law or the truth, a light of them which are in darkness. You feel then that you are an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, which has the form of knowledge and of the truth in the law. And here I see this sort of this imagery of the guardsmen, the keepers of the gate, if you will, these religious people who had the law. They were confident they could lead the blind, and they have voluntarily positioned themselves to say, this is the way you ought to be, this is the way you ought not to be. And what is clear here as I read these next few verses is, if you are going to get up and you teach someone else not to steal, you ought not to be stealing. Because if you teach people who are stealing and you are found out to be stealing, you nullify the strength of the truth. It's just that simple. You have spiritual nullification. In verse 21, he says, you therefore, which teach another, teach you not yourself. And I know Bronson and Vance, both of you feel that burden, as we all do, when you're up there. You're really speaking to yourself, not at someone specifically. But our preaching involves ourselves, not to exclude us, but to involve us. Then he goes on to say, "You that preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You that say a man should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery?" It's very simple. I mean, who are we, if we're involved in these types of immoral sins, to get up on the pulpit representing Jesus Christ and to take the freedom to say one thing and then in our lives, privately, we're doing something else? He goes on to say, "You that abhor idols, do you commit sacrilege? You that make your boast of the law, through breaking the law, dishonor you God." Then he says, "For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles through you, as it is written." And basically speaking, when you look back over the last 10 years, and that's the most frequent that comes to my mind, as someone I was talking to the other day related, he says, "Boy, I'll tell you what, religion or Christianity has gotten a black eye because there have been so many religious leaders who gave the appearance of being a certain way, and in reality, they were practicing just the opposite, and it caught up with them, and as a result of that, the name of Christ has been blasphemed."
The beauty of what Paul is doing here, in his most theologically sound presentation, Vance and I went through a series on the Book of Romans on our radio program for those who are listening to this tape now, and it was illuminating, I think, to understand the battle that Paul was waging here. When he turns his attention to the Jews here, the Jews had an advantage, which he argues in the next chapter. They had an advantage in that they had the oracles of God. They had the sayings of God. They had the law given to them that revealed what sin was. Paul makes that argument later in this book as well. So in having such an advantage, I think what Paul is arguing here in the verses that you've just gone through, Charles, is that, okay, you've got all of this advantage. In tennis terms, advantage means you're up in the score. And yet, in your leadership capacity, the reason you were created, the reason God chose the ancient nation of Israel, which included the Jews, he chose them to be an example of their trust of God, their faith in God, and how to live that high moral life and receive the blessings of God. He set before them life and death, blessings and cursings, told them to choose life. And yet, this passage here shows that they who could boast of the law, verse 23, "You boast of the law, but you break the law. You are dishonest towards God in the way that you live." Now, we could say the Jews, or he really got them. Paul just told them, didn't he? And Jesus, well, he worked on the Pharisees, didn't he? He just got those people told. But how do we apply this to ourselves? Because that's the ultimate intent of these verses, I believe, is to say, you, O man, you, O woman, you know, how are you going to be evaluated by your posture before God? I think that's the abiding thing that we're looking at today, so that our lives are not nullifications of the spirituality God would have us live.
You know, this concept we were talking about of the advantage of the Jew, this is what he has in mind. And this, what may appear to be a difficult text, verse 25 says, "For circumcision is indeed profitable if you keep the law." Some would say, well, what's the profit of circumcision? Well, again, he's talking about the advantage the Jew has, because after all, these are the people whose ancestors received the covenant. They're inheritors of the covenant. So circumcision is that covenant sign. And this is talking about relationship between them and God. "For circumcision is indeed profitable." That is to say, it's profitable because it is the covenant sign that you have between, that was given to you many, many, many centuries earlier. "For circumcision is indeed profitable if you keep the law." That's interesting, though, if you keep the law. But if you are a breaker of the law, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. That's no advantage at all. You lose all of that advantage. You receive the oracles of God. So what? You're a lawbreaker.
Right.
What kind of light can you be to the world? You know, Israel was to be a light to the world. But as it turns out, their circumcision became uncircumcision because they were lawbreakers. So there's no advantage. They lost that advantage. And therefore nullified the very purpose for their existence. Verse 26, therefore, if an uncircumcised man keeps the righteous requirements of the law, this is a Gentile, if he keeps the righteous requirements of the law, and this shows that there are universal principles, universal commandments within the law, he will not, will not his uncircumcision be counted as circumcision? Well, yes, of course. In other words, he has a relationship with God. Circumcision being a sign of that relationship or covenant, then he is in covenant relationship with God, even though he may be physically uncircumcised. Verse 27 says as much. And will not the physically uncircumcised, if he fulfills the law, judge you, who even with your written code and circumcision are a transgressor of the law? What kind of judgment is it, Bronson? Here you have a Greek, an uncircumcised Greek, someone with a pagan background. He turns to God through Jesus Christ. He becomes a law keeper. He's obedient. And here is this person over here who happens to be Jewish, and with all of this advantage, his ancestors having received the law, he was circumcised on the eighth day of his life, and he grew up hearing the law in the synagogues, and yet he's a transgressor. And here's the guy with a pagan background who is a law keeper.
This is a consistent argument that God makes throughout the Bible. In Ezekiel, he says, you will be judged by your own conduct, not that of your father. Your father can't get you in. Your mother can't get you into a relationship with God. It's based on your individuality. And I find that the verse over earlier, that there is no partiality with God in verse 11, comes through in this passage, because an uncircumcised, physically uncircumcised individual could be circumcised in heart and have a relationship with God, and that should put the onus on people who've been around the church, who've been so-called in the faith, who can quote the Ten Commandments, got them tacked up here and there, probably carrying them in their wallet, you know, feast days, you know, can tell you when everything is, count them down, but do not live the circumspect life. It's of no value. They are as if they were uncircumcised. That's Paul's argument.
You know, this this could be a case of reverse nullification, a reversal of the process, where you have the Gentile who keeps the righteous requirements of the law, yet he's uncircumcised, and some of the Jewish people could start to look at that and say, hey, wait a minute, what am I doing with my life?
Right.
And then they begin to keep the righteous requirements of the law as well. So it works both ways.
Right.
Verse 28, he continues, he says, for he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. He means simply that in God's sight, what really matters, it's not a matter of genetics, it's not a matter of this outward sign of circumcision in the flesh. Verse 29, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God. So whoever you are, it's the same. You can be condemned for disobeying God, or you can be blessed for obeying God. And certainly your example, what you do, what you say in relation to what you do, certainly has an effect on other people. It can work either way. It can nullify the whole message, or it can make people think and realize that there is something indeed to the message.
Well, really, when I look at these verses, and I'd like to offer just a couple suggestions as we wrap this up, as to what we can learn from this exercise of Romans chapter 2 that's tied in with Matthew chapter 23, is pretty simple. And that is that, first of all of us are sinners. We know that. We all have mistakes. We all have sins in our lives. And for those of us who are privileged enough to serve in their leadership role in a congregation, or to be able to preach and teach on behalf of the witness of Jesus Christ, what we live in our lives should shed light on the testimony of Jesus and not a contrasting darkness. In other words, there shouldn't be any confusion. In other words, if I get up and talk to you about something, I have to be doing it to the very best of my ability. Although, you know, we know we fall and we stumble, and I do not want to go into that necessarily to exacerbate it, but to just emphasize, hey, none of us are perfect. We know that. But I'll tell you something. I thought about doing this, but I thought it was too theatrical, and really that's part of the problem with the Pharisees. They were too theatrical and not involved in reality. So I thought, wouldn't it be something, one day I thought about coming into church, and I thought, well, I'll just be dressed improperly. You know, I'll just walk up on the pulpit, and I'll just have like a you know, old jeans on, an old beat up pair of tennis shoes, and I'll get up on the stage and I'll have a package of cigarettes in my left hand pocket, you know, and maybe even pull one out and light one up, and maybe have a little flask of whiskey on me too, and have my hair all undone and just sort of be askew. I thought about doing that, and I thought, well, no, that doesn't really set the right example, because people expect those who are involved in Christ, and especially to whatever degree of leadership you're in, is to live a certain example. Now, that's the point I wanted to make here. However, honestly, I could dress right, I could speak well, I could have a smile on my face, and yet that could be a cloak for hidden spiritual unfitness or disease. And that's what I learned from these verses. There's things much more important than that, and that is what's going on inside the individual and inside their heart. So what I learned here is that let's be careful about making these superficial judgments about how spiritual a person is based on certain religious activities or appearances. It makes a difference how zealous an individual can be. You know, Hitler was zealous, and he was dead wrong. You know, we tend to look at personalities. We tend to look at individuals who are out there, you know, and they're carrying on. They have an adventuresome spirit. But we're drawn to people who have the essence of spirituality, and yet those can all be false indicators of true discipleship.
Perhaps we should start living without blind spots, because I think that's a detriment to the message of the gospel and the things we're supposed to live, because, I mean, we've got these huge blind spots, these flaws or the planks in our eyes. It nullifies the effect of God's mercy and grace to people. They must see within us an experience of receiving those things in our own lives. If they have the sense that we are self-righteous, it turns them off. You know, there's no way that they can come to God. In other words, we are the guards that block the kingdom when we live by a standard that is self-righteous versus godliness and the things that Paul goes on to talk about throughout this particular letter. So living without blind spots, I think, is a good way to think about how we can not nullify, but to invigorate the ways of God.
You know, in the news recently, Bronson Vance, I don't know if you saw this, I was intrigued by a possibility up in, I believe it was in the outer reaches of Russia, there's a research team that discovered a woolly mammoth. You can say, well, how does that woolly mammoth fit into the subject? What intrigued me about it is that they hope to be able to extract some of the DNA from this creature that has been frozen in ice with a great big tusk sticking out for all these many centuries. They hope to clone that animal, and they hope possibly to recreate one today. And I got to thinking about the possibilities with that, because, and again, I hope that mankind does not dabble in that type of manipulation, but knowing man, they probably will. But you know what I find out here as I read Matthew 23 and Romans chapter 2 is we've got to be very careful about being guards at the gate and expecting people to be like us. That's the mistake, to expect people to be like us. You know who we're supposed to be like? If you want to make a clone and you want to be a clone of someone, you should be a clone of Jesus Christ, not of Charles Gross or Vance Stinson or Bronson or anybody else. Be a clone of Jesus Christ. And that's what I see as the essence of the teachings that we have gone through today. And you know something, Bronson Vance? If we're like Christ, if we're a clone of Jesus Christ, we are going to invigorate those that we come in contact with. We will not be involved in spiritual nullification. I think that's the essence of what we're talking about.
I think we would then be spiritual generators versus nullification.
I think you're exactly right.
Nullifiers, I should say. Yeah.
Well, I hope that all of those who are listening today can take a few moments to take out their Bibles and read through this subject and understand what we mean, what's implied here. And the essence of it is, let's be the very best people that we can. Let's not look to the wrong activities, the wrong attitudes. Let's look below appearances. Let's look for the genuineness of the message. And ultimately, let's be cloned and be exactly like Jesus Christ as best we can.
Thank you for listening to this cassette tape of The Church of God International. feel free to contact us with any additional literature or tape requests at Post Office Box 2525, Tyler, Texas 75710, or call 903-825-2525, or email us at armorofgod@email.com. Thank you.